Have you noticed by personal experience that telling someone to calm down is almost never a good idea? Have you noticed that? Try it with a child. Try it with a two-year-old who can't find their favorite toy, or look, try it with a 46-year-old man who's having a bad day. Like, calm down is just almost never good advice. It's almost never helpful. And you know, we're in our journey through the Psalms tonight, or today we're looking at the Psalms of Wisdom, and sometimes the Psalms of Wisdom can feel a little bit like that. So where the big idea between the Psalms of Wisdom is the wisdom of David saying, calm down. It's going to be okay. Let that alter how you actually live. Not just calm down right now, but like, let's set a life for ourselves where we're fretting less and where we're trusting more. And maybe to understand that, just in the same way where we're in the middle of a crisis, is no time to tell your buddy, calm down, dude. The Psalms of Wisdom come in a particular part of the thinking of the ancient wisdom model that we see in the book of Psalms. So we probably need to take a running start, and we'll do this a lot today, but you remember where all this started. We started with the Psalms of Lament, and we said, hey, there is a time where all you can think to do is cry out, and that is no time to not cry out. That is the time to be on your knees, on your face, ugly crying, right? Like they say, sackcloth and ashes. We're like, it's 3 p.m. and I'm in my jammies and I'm still angry, right? Like this is a cry. This is a time of just pouring out your heart. And there is language in the Psalms. There's like 50 Psalms that you could go to. You say, I don't know how to do that. David and other psalmists wrote it. You can just use their words. There is a time for just lament, just broken hearted crying out. And then there's this, but that's not where we live most of the time, right? Life is not just there. Life is a lot of things. And as we have times of crisis, of times of pain, times of sorrow where we're crying out, then we talked about royal psalms, where maybe the first step out of that pit is to be sure that in your heart, as is true in the universe, that you have enthroned Christ as king. And kind of the big idea when we talked about the royal psalms or the Psalms of Enthronement was the kind of the catch line that day was like, look, if Jesus is still on the throne, then it's going to be okay. And you have to start there, right? And can you picture times where you do this? You come out of the fog of sorrow or some tragedy in your life has surprised you. And you just didn't handle it well and you're just crying out. And then you kind of remember, wait a minute, Jesus is still on his throne. We're going to be okay. But it doesn't necessarily solve the riddle of my heart right now. And then we talked about the Psalms of Trust. That was last week where we said not only if Jesus is on the throne, it's going to be okay, but man, we need to be people who actually trust Jesus, that the empty tomb, that the reality of the cross, that these things are so central to us that we live our lives trusting him. And kind of that next step is these Psalms of Wisdom. So the wisdom psalms are the point which we're trusting God so much that it changes our mindset and our behavior. It's when you decide that you don't want to be blown away by every wind and instead you want a game plan, you want a paradigm. Like this is after the tragedy, but understanding that there's another tragedy coming, right? The book of Ecclesiastes is my favorite book in the Bible. And let me sum it up for you. If you are in a valley, keep your head up. A peak is coming. If you're on a mountain peak, don't get cocky. Like there's a valley coming, right? Like this is all going to be the life experience under the sun. We're waiting for this time when God makes everything right. And right now we're in this in-between time and there's just going to be sorrow. So the Psalms of Wisdom are for the time when you've come to say, yes, God, you are still on the throne. Jesus, the cross still is the center of my life. I trust you. And then we apply that. And the applying of trust is where our life actually changes. And we say, look, I don't think this is the last time we're going to have a national tragedy. I don't think this is the last time I'm going to have a personal tragedy. I don't think this is the last time I'm going to make a big mistake. I don't think this is the last time I'm going to be a failure. I don't think this is the last time people are going to let me down. So how does this experience in learning to trust God actually help me survive these things as we come up? This is wisdom, where we have a new kind of plan for the next set of struggles. Because we need more than external tools. And there's a lot of external tools, and the world's full of them, and coping mechanisms and ways to, you know, everything from counting to 10 to diet and exercise. There's all kinds of ways to like live a wiser life. But at the end of it, we need more than just external stuff. We need like what the Bible talks about when it says a transformed heart. Amen. To actually approach these things like Jesus did. Right? Romans 12 famously says that we need to be living sacrifices. So there's something about the core of us that has to die, that we have to die to ourselves, right? That we have to not just be a better version of us, but we have to like die to us so that we can actually say Christ lives in me. So we have to be living sacrifices, and then not only that, but we have to not be conformed to the patterns of this world. We need to not approach life like the rest of the people around us are approaching life, that are the death of ourself, married to the death of cross, and the hope of our future, married to the empty tomb, has not only caused us to die to ourselves, but has also caused us to not live life like the rest of the world lives life. You know, Ed Stetzer has written a book recently that I haven't read, but I read the title. I think I'm halfway there. And he talks about being a Christian in the age of outrage. That just outrage is so popular right now. That it's very easy to be outraged, and we all kind of get sucked in, right? Like we'll see a tweet and be like, I think the world needs my opinion on this, and I think it needs to be forceful so it stands out. And that is just the pattern of the world. But what it means to die to ourselves, and what it means to have Christ enthroned in our lives, and what it means to have that kind of emotional honesty where I say, hey, in the valley, I can cry out to God, is that we have a different pattern of life. And then Paul continues in chapter 12 of Romans to say, so you know this, living sacrifices, no longer be conformed to the pattern of life around you, and then you need to have a transformed mind by the renewing of our minds, Paul says. So I think the wisdom psalms, and actually all of the wisdom literature that we have, so there's some of it in Job, and Proverbs are almost exclusively that, and Ecclesiastes has a bunch of it, and then there's wisdom stuff scattered throughout the Old Testament. And this whole wisdom like pattern of ancient Israel that we've been handed to is fleshed out in this idea that our mind needs to be transformed, and the pattern of our life can't be like the pattern of life that is all around us. So there is a place for great lament in a relationship with God. There is a place for just, it stinks, life is lame, I can't get past that. God, I know you're true, but I can't feel it, and just crying out. But there's also room for growing a new perspective. There's also room for transformation, for a new way to look at life, so that we can not only be emotionally honest with God and emotionally honest with in general, which is just so healthy. Just if you're miserable, just to name it and be like, I'm miserable. God, I'm miserable today. That's just so healthy to be able to be emotionally honest. But not only can we be emotionally honest, but that we can also grow in our emotional honesty. We can grow emotionally. You know, when it comes to sorrow, it's, you know, often said, and I think it's right, that through sorrow is the only way out of it. You know, there's no ignoring it. You got to go all the way through it. But let's remember that there is a way out. That Jesus did die on the cross. That there is the hope of heaven. So we have to learn, and the Psalms are beautiful about giving us the tools to move through sorrow and the language of sorrow, but also the language of growth as we climb out of sorrow. We can kind of get stuck, I think, in a cycle of lament and trust where the same things, the same relationships, the same activities, the same newscasts, the Twitter feed, the same whatever it is, just wrecks us over and over and over and over and over, and we're getting better at crying out and saying, God, everything's bad, but trusting God. Like we can kind of be stuck in this cycle where you would hope that over the course of our lives we just grow emotionally, where the same things don't wreck us anymore. So wisdom draws us into a long-term plan of response, a game plan, so that we not only move through the process of lament and enthronement and trust, and eventually next week we'll get to thankfulness. We not only move through that, but also that we move through it more quickly. More that we grow in the Lord to the point where we are spending less time in sorrow and more time in joy. So let's say your boss does something that drives you nuts. Reason for lament, right? Just a terrible human that does terrible human things, and you're faced with this daily, and there's no getting out of it. You're going to have to go to work, and this guy or girl's going to have to be there. He's a guy, let's be honest. And does terrible things, and you're stuck in this cycle of like, oh my gosh, he said this mean thing again, and I go home and I cry out to God, and wouldn't you like to get to the point where you go, it doesn't bother me anymore? But not that it doesn't bother me anymore because I've gone calloused and I've learned to ignore it, but because I just so trust God. My eyes are so fixed on him that the same things that bothered me before, the same things that used to wreck my heart, no longer do it. Or maybe it's failure, you know? Maybe you're struggling with failure in your own life, and you go, man, I just don't feel like I have a lot of worth, and I've made mistakes, and I don't know what to do about it. And you've had a season of lament, you've had a season of crying out, and you've had a season of, like, telling God how guilty you feel and feeling you know, refreshed by him. But that same, like, program is in your head reminding you all the time that you failed. Like, wouldn't we like to be people who've grown to the point where we can hear the same message and have it not completely wreck us anymore, but where we have so learned to enthrone Christ in our lives that it's made a long-term difference? So the goal is not just understanding that we can pour out our hearts to God, but that actually living differently. That's the goal, living differently as we grow in him. So there's a whole bunch of Psalms that help us with this. Help us think through not just times of crisis, but kind of time after crisis. Or maybe we think of it as time in between crisis, because I promise, more crisis is coming. And this is the big idea about wisdom in the scriptures in general, or just what the word wisdom means. It means skill in living, right? It means being, getting better, growing, more maturity, getting better at just the skills it takes to be alive. Maturity in Christ is not instant, and wouldn't it be great if we just came to the Lord and we're like, now I'm emotionally like tough and Jesus is all I need and I don't need, like nothing bothers me anymore because I love Jesus so much. Look, maturity, and that's not the way Jesus lived. So I don't know that we would expect to ever be immune from the world because Jesus certainly was soft-hearted. And yet, wouldn't it be great to get to that point where we say, you know, I'm actually growing in my emotional maturity. Maturity in Christ is not instant, but it does grow. Some might say like a mustard seed. So the scriptures would say that not only can times of lament like lead to growth, but even that growth can be a joyful experience. And we'll get to the Psalms just here in a second, but let's think about this too. There's a bunch of literature in the scriptures that would have language like James 1, where it says, consider it pure joy when you experience trials of many kinds. Why? Because trials are fun? Because everybody loves trials. Because I just love people being mean to me, and I love like just tell me about some hurricane that wrecked a village somewhere. Like, what a joy. No, that's silly. No, trials are bad. But the trials in our life can produce a maturity in us that is joyful. Consider it pure joy when you're growing. And God can use trials to do it. So the Psalms of Wisdom are not for times of lament. However, they are for times when you've decided that lament and trust might not be the full circle and we want to grow. I want to land on Psalm 37 here in a second, but can I just give you kind of let me read just a few psalms to you that are good examples of psalms of wisdom, and we'll just touch on them very, very briefly. Psalm 1, if you have a Bible with you, Psalm 1 is the first chapter in Psalms. Making sure you're awake. It's a little warm in here today. I was telling somebody I might fall asleep during the sermon. It's a little warm. So if you need a nap, go ahead. Psalm 1 starts like this. It said, "Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. He is like a tree planted by streams of water that yields its fruit in season and its leaf does not wither. In all that he does, he prospers. The wicked are not so, but are like chaff that the wind drives away." So this psalm has a pretty simple message. Do you hear the wisdom in it? Like, your life will go better. That's what blessing means, like a better life. Your life will go better if you pick better confidants. If you pick better counselors, if you hang out with wiser people who don't do dumb stuff, your life is going to go better. Now, that's pretty simple. And that is probably not the time. Like, when your child has just wrecked their life and their dumb friends made them do dumb things and they're sitting and they're like, they're emotionally destroyed, is probably not the time to be, "Well, you know, Psalm 1 says that you'll be blessed." No, that's a time for lament. That's a time for crying out. "Ah, dude, I'm so sorry. This is so hard. Let's cry out together." But they're coming. Comes a time when you go, if I want my life to go better, I should pick better friends. I should be around better people. Psalm 1 says your life will go worse if you hang around people who are antagonistic towards God. It says you'll dry up. Godly friends are like a stream that feeds us, like being planted by waters. And without godly friends, we feel dry and blown around. Should you come to an in-group? Do you have to come to an in-group? No. Should you? Yeah. Like, without godly friends, we're just out there in the desert by ourselves. It's wisdom. Turn over to Psalm 32. Psalm 32 says, "Blessed is the one whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Blessed is the man against whom the Lord counts no iniquity, in whose spirit there is no deceit. For when I kept silent, my bones wasted away through all my groanings all day long. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My strength was dried up as by the heat of summer. I acknowledged my sin to you and did not cover my iniquity. I said, I will confess my transgression to the Lord, and you forgave the iniquity of my sin. Therefore, let everyone who is godly offer prayer so that you may be found." So your life will go better if you are right with God. Amen? If there's something in between you and God, like, confess it. Hiding sin from God leads to inner pain and inner struggle, and confession leads to a sense of relief. So do you see what I'm saying? That this might not be the psalm for the times of deepest sorrow. In fact, this might be the kind of psalm that good-hearted Christian people have used to just straight up bludgeon their Christian friends. Like, "I'm just so sorrowful." Well, have you prayed about it? Oh, dude, they've prayed about it. They're crying out. This is where Job's friends made the mistake, right? Job just lost his whole family, and they're like, "Well, you must have sin." Look, there's a time for that. In the middle of a lament is not. But there is a time. Do we want to live better lives? Do we want to grow? Do we want to live wiser, more skillful lives? Learn to confess. Learn to cry out in that way. Psalm 78. Why don't you turn over to Psalm 78 real quick? Last one. Psalm 78, as we read it, we might need to dedicate a baby. It's what I always read. Not always, but it's what I frequently read when we're dedicating a baby. And it says this: "Give ear, O my people, to my teachings. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable, and I will utter dark sayings from old, things that we have not heard and known, that our fathers have told us." This, by the way, the psalmist frequently is much like a modern-day rapper, and I'm not kidding. Like, there's this part, the first part of the song is like, I'm the man. Like, this is what I'm about to do. Like, this is how modern day, like, rap songs go. And frequently, like, that's how Greek writing goes, and this is how the songs go too. So he's like, you know, you could, somebody else have to beatbox. But "I'm going to open my mouth in a parable, and I will utter dark sayings of old, things that we have heard and known, that our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from our children, but tell to the coming generations the glorious deeds of the Lord and his might and the wonders that he has done." Do you see the wisdom there? Like, our life will go better if we be sure to tell our kids about the things that God has done. So this is for the time after the time, when you've cried yourself out and you've reminded yourself that Jesus is on the throne and you trust him, and now you're saying, how can I live a more wise life? Now turn to Psalm 37 and we'll dig in a little bit. Psalm 37. That just was read to us is this beautiful psalm. And just a few things I want to point out from Psalm 37. First of all, Psalm 37 assumes that the earthly success of the wicked. That's in the Bible. Psalm 37 assumes that there's going to be times when you look around and you go, do the bad guys win? Is that what's happening? Like this, like put that in your wisdom model, right? Like Psalm 37 is not cowboys with white hats are the good guys and cowboys with black hats are the bad guys. And at the end, the cowboys on the white horse and the white hat, they end up winning. No, Psalm 37 looks out and goes, man, it sure seems like the wicked do pretty well. True. Have you not looked out and thought, it sure looks like the wicked do pretty well? It surely wants us to know that deep down there is justice, that the wicked will be brought to justice and righteousness will be defended, but that takes a much longer view, and psalms like Psalm 37 are so helpful in that way. I feel like believers can have a couple of kind of opposite and equally unbiblical responses to the success of the wicked. We can look at our culture and go, hey, the good guys are losing, the bad guys are winning. There's no justice in the world. And look, injustice is hugely important. You cannot pray, God, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven, and then not care about injustice. We have to care about the oppressed. We have to care about the poor. Like, this is just what it means to be a Christian. And yeah, we can look around and go, man, it sure seems like the wicked are winning. And so there's a couple of like opposite reactions we can have. I think neither one of them are wise. The first one I would say is like heaven-inspired apathy, right? Like, oh, well, the world's bad, but God is good, and someday it'll all work out in heaven. Is that what God's called us to? No, certainly he's called us to be his hands and feet, that we would be the implement of justice, that we would be those who serve the poor best, that care for the downtrodden, that feed the hungry, that dress the unclothed, that visit the prisoner. Like, that is what it means to love the Lord. And yet some people have this apathy that's like inspired by the future. And maybe the other and opposite version of that is like heaven ignored anger, like that we act like there's not going to be ultimate justice. And so every bit of injustice like causes this like righteous anger, and we feel there's just wrath dwelling up. Like, you know what the world needs is like the wrath of Grant, like right now. And Psalm 37 would say, no, neither one of those are the proper response, but Psalm 37 is going to assume that you're going to look around and go, this is a mess. It sure seems like the unrighteous, the wicked, prosper. So how do we grow? What's a biblical worldview if we look out the window and see that? Well, a few things. First of all, there's some things that wisdom gets rid of. Psalm 37 starts with this incredible verse that I just feel like I could read to myself every single day and never fully understand the depth of it. It says, fret not yourself because of evildoers. Be not envious of wrongdoers. Hey, Christians, is Jesus on the throne? Do you trust him? Then fret not over wrongdoers. Globally, nationally, personally, in your own house, if Jesus is really the king, and if you really trust him, fret not. Isn't fretting a great word? It's not just don't worry. It's not just, hey, calm down, stop worrying. There are some things that we should totally, as believers, there's some things we should totally worry about. We should worry about the lost around us. We should worry about the conditions of our heart. We should worry about standing with each other in unity. We should worry about being salt and light to the world. But you know what ends up happening is those things that God has said, hey, these are the things I want you to be concerned about, they kind of go to the wayside. And the things that God has said, I'll take care of that, those are the things that we worry about. So David says, just don't worry about evildoers. And you might say, well, I thought the Psalms gave us permission to feel the full range of human emotion, and certainly anger is a human emotion, right? Like, shouldn't I be able to feel that? Totally. Absolutely. But they also teach us how to experience our emotions in a way where we're in control of them instead of the other way around, where we're not swayed and wrecked by every human emotion, including anger, wrath, where emotions are not stifled, but they're also not running loose, where our emotions are surrendered to God, where grief and joy and celebration and concern, these things are super biblical and pointed at God. These are the things that bring us closer to Him. And the thing with fretting, the thing with worry about evildoers, is that we are usually concerned with things that are God's business instead of the things that God has given us to be concerned about. I'm so worried that my life will be difficult. I'm so worried that that person has offended me. I'm so worried that there's injustice in the world. And those are the things that God has said, will you not trust that I'm your provider? Will you not trust that I love you? Will you not trust that I am just and that at the end of all of this, righteousness prevails? Then verse 1 wraps up just by saying, and be not envious of wrongdoers. All right, I realize this is just me because I'm immature, but have you noticed how easy it is to be jealous of wrongdoers? Have you noticed how sometimes it seems like wrongdoers, which I love it, wrongdoer is my new favorite word. Let's try to use it 10 times this week. Wrongdoer, I don't even know. But where you look at people who are living lives that are clearly antagonistic to the gospel and you go, it seems like they're having the best time. It seems like they're making the most money. It seems like they have the most prestige. It seems like lying works. It even sounds like they make a lot of sense when I hear them talk sometimes. Doesn't it seem sometimes like the bullies win? Even you notice it, like every once in a while there's a comeuppance. You know what I mean? Like, didn't you just love the kind of first few months of the Me Too kind of awakening where it was like, oh, there have been terrible people and they're getting what's coming to them finally. Like, yes, but you know full well that there's a bunch of terrible people right now that aren't getting what's coming to them, right? Like, you look around and we go, we did not solve sexism. We have not solved racism. We have not solved injustice. And sometimes you look and go, man, those times of reckoning are just not enough. And the times of the wicked prospering sure seem like they happen all the time. Here's the thing with envy. Envy is the idea that God is taking care of others, but not me. That God, why are you giving them what they need, what they want? Why do they seem so happy? Why do they seem so satisfied? And I just never do. Maybe there's somebody at your office that lied to get a promotion. Maybe there's a neighbor who's a constant source of trouble in the neighborhood, but they just seem happy as a clam. Maybe you even go, but you don't understand. I deserve to be envious. Like you might be justified in your envy, but the Psalms would say that envy lacks wisdom. If Jesus is in charge, and if you trust that the grave is empty, then fret not evil people. Don't be envious of wrongdoers. And then, you know, we're told why in Psalm 37. Verse 2 says, look, there is a human brevity that makes it just silly to be envious of the wicked. It says, they will soon fade like grass and wither like the green herb. The verse 9 talks about the ineffectiveness of the wicked. Verse 9 says, for the evildoer shall be cut off. That's beautiful language. I want to, like, why don't you put your finger on verse 9 right there and read it again. For the evildoer shall be cut off, but those who wait for the Lord shall inherit the land. That's like covenant language, right? That's like, look, what God had promised the people of Israel is that they would have a homeland and that they would have family, that they would have inheritance. And And the psalmist is saying, look, I know right now it looks like the bad guys are winning, but look, evildoers will be cut off. Like in the end, they will not have the homeland and you will. And that's Old Testament, like covenant language, but it is pretty easy to bring into the New Testament, isn't it? Like it might look like righteousness, like honesty, like integrity doesn't work right now. It might look like the bad guys win now, but man, have a longer view of the world. Life is so short. And our inheritance is so sure. Also, it just talks about the ineffectiveness of the wicked. If Jesus is enthroned, if we trust him, then worry turns to confidence. Envy turns to missionary concern. We start looking at people going, look at them faking. Look at the wicked acting like they have all they need, when really the thing that is the biggest problem in their life is that they are cut off from God. And I might not have everything that the world has, but all of the problems in my life have been solved by the empty tomb. Like I am at peace with God, and there is this world that like is trying to convince me that it's winning and it's happy, but really I am so concerned that they are cut off from a relationship with God. So instead of envy, we start, I don't know if pity is the right word, concern, like love might be the word, for the lost. The success of the wicked is not their problem. They are cut off from God. Jesus' prayer was forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. Verse 12 and 13 says, the wicked plots against the righteous and gnashes his teeth at them, but the Lord laughs at the wicked, for he sees that his day is coming. Look, the day is coming. Would you just remind yourself of that? In the middle of every ache and pain, in the middle of every sorrow, in the middle of every time where the bad guys are winning, instead of envy and worry, let's be people of missionary zeal, of self-denying service. Romans says that the wicked are storing up wrath for the day of judgment, and I can't see that we would have the heart of God as we say evil people are storing up wrath for the day of judgment. Good. I hope they get what's coming to them. I hope we would look and go, I was that sinner. I was storing up wrath for the day of judgment. I don't know why Jesus loved me so much that he solved that problem for me. Now I'm storing up treasure in heaven, and I'm so concerned about the world that they're storing up wrath, that there is a day coming. Instead of envy, we should care about their heart. That's wisdom. So there's going to be another national tragedy, and there's going to be another tragedy in your life, and there's going to be bad things that happen. And lament is there for you. And the enthronement psalms are there for you. But right now, I wonder what would happen if we said, you know, I'm just not going to be envious of the evildoer. I'm just not going to, when it seems like the bad guys are winning, instead of rage, instead of envy, instead of pride, what I'm going to feel is concerned for them. It's almost like we're supposed to love our enemy and pray for those who persecute us. I mean, do you believe that we're storing up treasures in heaven? Do you believe that there's storing up wrath? There's also this ineffectiveness in the world. In verse 16 says, better is the little that the righteous have than the abundance of many wicked. Just let that sit in. Better is the little that the righteous have rather than the abundance of many wicked. As you look around at the world and you see bad guys winning and you see bad stuff happening and it is so important to go, you know, I know that stuff doesn't work. All these things that the world is promoting is like, this is how our heart gets satisfied. It just doesn't work. Don't be envious of stuff that doesn't work. And third and lastly, it says you know, another thing that wisdom gets rid of is anger and wrath. And we've talked about this a little. Verse 8 says, refrain from anger and forsake wrath. Guys, this is just the wisdom of the Psalms. In the age of outrage, in the age of everybody has a strong opinion about absolutely everything, and you're the one who thinks right, and your idiot friend is an idiot. And what? In the middle of all of that, the wisdom of the Psalms is this, just refrain from anger and put away wrath. The wisdom psalms remind us that anger is not a godly expression. Can I say this? Because the world is so the opposite of this. The wisdom psalms remind us that anger is not a godly response to the wickedness of the world. And that sounds weird. Jesus got angry, right? Yeah. At the church. For putting up barriers that stopped people from coming in. For hypocrisy in the church. But when he addressed the wicked, it was with sacrifice and forgiveness. James, again, says it so plainly. James 1:20 says this, "The anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God." It's unproductive. Get rid of it. I mean, hey, church, do we want to produce the righteousness of God in our lives? Do we want to produce the righteousness of God in our culture, in our neighborhoods? The wrath, the anger of man will never produce the righteousness of God. So wisdom psalms don't only tell us what mindset to shed, but very quickly, let's hop on a few things that we replace those things with. So as we shed anger, as we shed wrath, as we shed envy, as we shed fretting, verse 3 simply says, "Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and befriend faithfulness." Maybe instead of in the place of worry, in the place of worrying about the faults of others, it's wise to consider how we might do good. How we might be active participants in the will of God in the world. Practically, it's really tough to worry about how everybody else needs to change while you're working on how you need to change and how you might reflect God more fully. Verse 4 says, "Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart." Man, what a misunderstood verse. Don't we love the second half of that verse? Like the Bible says, "God, give me the desires of my heart." Well, not if the desires of your heart are totally self-centered. No, it says, "Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desire of your heart." People who work on being delighted in God find delight. Learn to delight yourself in the Lord. We don't do this without effort. Spiritual disciplines grow on you. Time in the Word grows on you. Like delighting in maturity grows on you. But this is like the opposite view of God being a God of just prohibitions, right? When we first come to God, it's easy to just kind of go, these are the things we can't do. And even as we've just talked, like, okay, so get rid of envy and get rid of fretting and get rid of anger. And it sounds like, oh, is this all just about what we don't do? No, actually, this is what it's like. God desires that you would delight in him and him alone. So learn to delight in him instead of all this other stuff. Like, I wonder if, like, you invited me over to your house and you're like, "Grant, come and we will feed you and put your feet up and we have a huge TV and we promise the angels are going to win and it's perfectly comfortable, and there's chili dogs and whatever," right? Just be like, this is the perfect Grant scenario. And you'd be like, it's free. Would you just come and be delighted at our house? And I'd be like, oh, it sounds like what you're telling me is you won't let me drive off a cliff. And you'd be like, I mean, if you want to drive off a cliff, but does driving off a cliff delight you? Like, is that where the good stuff is? God has called us into a relationship where he would be our delight. And we go, oh, does that mean I can't do this and I can't do that? And it's like, sure, if you want to sin, go try it. Go see if it works. But how about instead of that, you learn to delight yourself in the Lord? Verse 5 says, "Commit your ways to the Lord, trust in him, and he will act. He will bring forth your righteousness as the light and your justice as the noonday." Not that, and God will go get all the bad guys and solve all the problems of the world, but the problems of the world have been solved at the cross. And what will be elevated is you being salt and light. He will bring forth your righteousness as light and your justice as noonday. What are you delighting in? Are you in a time between times of lament? Like, are you grateful that lament is available to you, but right now is not a crisis? What to do at that time is to lean into the Psalms of wisdom and say, how does my perspective align with God?